I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is going to be physicist Roberto Trotta. What in the heck are we doing with a physicist on a show about literature, about poetry and fiction and memoir? Well, stick around, because the new book that he just wrote, called The Edge of the Sky, has amazing parallels to poetry, and you're going to find out why if you stick with us. And this guy is incredibly interesting. As I said, his name is Roberto Trotta. He's Italian, but currently he is in Copenhagen, so we're going to call him in Copenhagen, and he is teaching physics at the same university where Niels Bohr taught. And I don't know if you know who Niels Bohr is, but if you know anything about quantum mechanics, even nothing like me, then you know that Niels Bohr was fundamental in contributing to the understanding of atomic structure and quantum theory. But another reason why I'm going to have this physicist on the show, other than the fact that his book is incredibly parallel to how we write poetry, another reason is because the fact is, writers love metaphor. We're all about the metaphor, or like I like to say, we're about the metaphorical possibility. We don't lock into metaphors, but we allow metaphors to exist. And the culture is shifting in such a way that writers are using less biblical metaphors, less religious metaphors, which really have ruled literature for hundreds and hundreds of years, and we're starting to use metaphors around physics. Jorge Luis Borges used to read the Bible a lot. He knew the Bible better than most people, but he read it as fantasy literature. He didn't read it as a religious person. He said about the New Testament that it created new metaphors. And he says there have been no new metaphors since the New Testament. And as an example, he talks about that saying that Jesus says, "Would you throw pearls before swine?" Borges says, "Is that a great metaphor? Who could have thought of that?" Well, Borges was right for a time, because the new metaphors now are physics. A lot of literature, a lot of art, and a lot of our cultural conversation depends on the metaphors of physics, and it's on its way to replacing religious metaphor. In fact, it's kind of interesting how many people who today don't even know the metaphors of Christianity or the metaphors of Judaism, they pretty much are lost when you make references. The other day I was hanging out with a friend, and he said, "My friend of mine is doing paintings of the saints, you know, people like Moses." And I says, "Moses wasn't a saint." We're beginning to lose the grasp of religious metaphor, and we are replacing it with metaphors of physics. So we're going to go from metaphors like God is always watching you to observation changes the phenomenon. We're going to go from metaphors to like when you betray somebody and they say, "You're a Judas." Now we're going to say, "You believe in the cosmological constant." And that would be a very funny joke. Physicists right now are laughing. The cosmological constant basically was Einstein's mathematical equation to prove that the universe wasn't expanding, a concept that he just could not believe, even though his own mathematics showed that it was expanding. And later on, when he finally accepted the universe is expanding, he was kind of embarrassed about the cosmological constant. It was the Judas equation. And although I must say that Judas today has different meaning than he did before. In fact, Judas now is kind of a cult hero. There's Judas Priest, and there's all this idea of identification with Judas. And as we know, or at least as physicists tell us, the cosmological constant that Einstein used to argue against expansion of the universe is now used to describe dark matter. So it's coming back just like Judas. Instead of saying, "I have my own cross to bear," now we're going to say, "I have to drag myself through the Higgs field." Okay, what is the Higgs field? We probably have heard of this on the periphery. The Higgs field is, well, let's just say the metaphor is going from God the Father to God the particle. The biggest thing in physics since the confirmation of the Big Bang theory is the discovery of the Higgs boson. Now, let's see, how can I explain the Higgs boson without using math? The Higgs boson is basically the holy grail of physics. It unites quantum mechanics with cosmology. It is the particle that physicists have imagined through mathematics that would tie quantum mechanics and cosmology together. It is one of the most elementary particles that is going to allow physicists to put these two branches of physics together in a way that they've never been able to do before. When you look at the rules of cosmology and the rules of quantum mechanics, everything breaks down, nothing can be understood, so they had to come up with some sort of theories like, you know, the incredibly imaginative string theory, or the standard model of physics, which is where the Higgs boson fits in. The Higgs boson is the particle that is missing, that explains how everything fits together. And I know I'm probably not explaining this well, so let me put it in metaphor. The Higgs boson, if we discover the Higgs boson, then we have discovered the mind of God. So the Higgs boson is also known as the God particle. Now, here's how I can explain it. Let's look at the Tower of Babel. The Tower of Babel is a story wherein a bunch of people got together and they wanted to reach God. They wanted to reach God in many ways the same way that physicists want to know the mind of God. And so they started to make brick and build this tower. And the idea was that they were going to build it high enough in order to reach God, and then they would know everything. And as they're building it, God looks down at them and says, wait a minute, man, I can't let these guys do this. No way. So what did God do? God confused their language so that they wouldn't be able to communicate. He created different languages so that suddenly the people who are working together and saying, hey, John, give me another brick, couldn't communicate anymore. And so they couldn't reach God. That's the Tower of Babel. And CERN, which is in Switzerland and France, is the most ambitious undertaking to reach God, the particle, since the Tower of Babel. And what it is people from all over the world, physicists from everywhere, got together, and under one language, the language of math, they began to build not up, but down into the ground. It costs 5 billion euros, and what it is, it's a Large Hadron Collider where they slam particles at nearly the speed of light, and that is the only way that they are going to find God, the particle. So CERN, in essence, is the new metaphor for the Tower of Babel. Only instead of God confusing their language, the language of mathematics has actually allowed them to find what they believe is the God particle. Just recently, it has been discovered. And so God has been reached through the language of mathematics. Well, as a metaphor anyway. So, oh, ye of little faith, God, the particle, has been discovered. And let's hope that he doesn't kill us all. The fact is, physics has replaced the Bible as our main metaphorical well from which we draw the water of our literature. And they both seek the same thing, to know the mind of God, to understand everything. Or as Roberto Trotta says in his wonderful book, to understand the all there is. Stick around, and we're going to talk to Roberto Trotta about the all there is, and you're going to find the poetry in physics.
Some particle physicists were standing one day, and a hadron collider in CERN. They gazed at the buttons and the output display, for the projects they had to adjourn.
Roberto Trotta is a theoretical cosmologist in astrophysics. His research in cosmology is analyzing, interpreting, and making sense of cosmological observations, which is kind of what we do on the show here. He is a science communicator, a statistical consultant, a scientific consultant, and now he is author of an amazing book that explains the universe in the 1,000 most common used words in the English language. It's called The Edge of the Sky. It's an amazing book. Roberto, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And I have to say, you are the very first physicist we've ever had on the show. We had a neurologist one time because we were talking about humor, but you're the very first physicist. Usually we have poets and fiction writers. So
it's a special honor as a physicist then to be on your show.
Well, you know, the thing is, your book, The Edge of the Sky, is almost, to me, it reminds me of what poets and fiction writers do in the sense that, well, why don't you explain the book, and then I'll chime in on how I think it's so much like poetry.
The book is a little bit experimental in nature. The idea behind The Edge of the Sky is to try and talk about the universe, that's to say the all there is in the language of the book, by using only the most common 1,000 words in the English language. And so what I'm trying to do with the book is to talk about everything we've learned about the nature of the universe, where it came from and what it's made of, and all the big mysteries that still remain about the dark side of the universe, dark matter, dark energy, which in the book is called the dark push, in a very simple, straightforward way that anybody can understand. And so it's half science popularization and half literary experiment. And so in this way, I hope to be able to reach out to a wider community and a wider cross-section of the public and talk about the great science that we do nowadays in my discipline, the study of the universe.
If you're limiting yourself to 1,000 most common used words in the English language, I don't imagine the word universe is on that list. So how do you refer to it? Is that what the all there is?
Precisely. The all there is the universe. And as I started writing this book, I really started banging my head against the limitations of my very, very small lexicon. And so I don't have words like gravity or force. I don't have planets. I don't have galaxies. So all of these words that I don't have, I've made up using different expressions, using the most common 1,000 words.
Yeah, I suppose it would be difficult at first, at least, you know, until you find your rhythm, because I think when we write poetry, when we write even literary etudes, which is, you know, this is kind of like a literary etude, that once you find your rhythm, it becomes a lot more smooth and a lot less work. But at first, finding words to replace energy and particle must have been quite a challenge.
Yeah, the challenge was very frustrating in the beginning, because I started this project as an experiment to see how far I could stretch this format, whether I could make it work at book length. And so at the beginning, I really didn't know what to use in place of all these words that I didn't have. But then, little by little, this new voice emerged almost by itself, from the format itself. And this almost poetic straitjacket, if I dare say so, forced me to think about those ideas in a new way. And so planets, for example, became crazy stars because they don't go around like normal stars. They go back and forth on the sky, or they appear to do so. And then galaxies became star crowds, and the Milky Way became the white road, and so on and so forth. And so from this new language that was created by the lexicon itself, a new voice started to emerge, and that's the voice that the book itself sort of created for me. And then it became easier, it became smoother, and I got into the rhythm, and I really got into it, and I loved doing it.
And I imagine after a while, you kind of, I don't suppose you memorized all 1,000 words, but after a while, you must have just instinctively known whether or not a word was going to be on the list.
Yes, at the beginning, it was a lot of backspace and deleting and trying to express things in different ways. And then little by little, I started really getting into the groove and understanding which words I could use and which I couldn't. And once the vocabulary was in place, the basic building blocks of my new language were in place, then I could really start speaking this new language, almost like learning a new language, in fact, and I enjoyed it much more.
Like you said, when you have to articulate concepts without using the words that you would normally use, it's like learning another language as an adult. When you learn another language as an adult and you encounter words that you don't know, the language experts, the language teachers tell you, don't look it up in an English-Spanish dictionary, for example. If you're learning Spanish, look it up in a Spanish dictionary. And then when you look it up in a Spanish dictionary and you hear the description of it, it's almost as if it's a new concept, a new image, even though it's so familiar before. And I'll give the word, like, for example, the word mecha. In Spanish, it's basically a wick or a fuse on a candle. But when you look it up in the Spanish, here's the definition. Tubo relleno de pólvora para dar fuego a minas y barrenos.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, when you look at it that way, it's like it becomes this whole new word, this whole new image. And I imagine there were these epiphany moments that you've had perhaps many times while writing this book.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, those very same concepts, those concepts that I thought I was familiar with, the concepts in cosmology about the Big Bang and the way the universe became to be and what it is made of, etc., all these sometimes abstract and frankly a little bit removed from reality ideas that we have in my field, I thought I understood them in my mathematical and everyday work language. But when I was forced to think about them in this new language, as you aptly described, I was really forced to come up with new images and new ways of visualizing them mentally, new pictures that are now shining a new light on them for me. And I very much hope that my readers will also see these concepts and these ideas, whether they've encountered them before or not, in this new refreshing light, see them with new eyes and perhaps understand them better or come up with new mental images that will make them click into place for them in their minds. And so this is really my aim, to look at the universe with fresh new eyes that are childlike in a sense because of the very limited vocabulary, but hopefully will also be new and surprising for everybody.
For example, physicist is not on the list of 1,000 words, so you had to call him...
Student people. That's right. Yes, exactly. After all, you know, physicists and scientists, what do? We study things all our lives, so we become student people. So one of the main characters of the book is a student woman who goes out to a big seer, that's to say one of the biggest telescopes on Earth, to ask his help to unlock the mystery of dark matter. And so the telescope itself, Big Seer, becomes the second character in the book, a very silent character, but a very important one, who is helping our protagonist to try and understand what dark matter is made of. And the book follows their adventures throughout one night of observations as they try to find out dark matter, and the student woman thinks back at what the universe is made of and how we came to understand its mysteries, and the part of the mysteries that we understand and the big mysteries that we still don't understand, and the questions that we're still asking about the older age.
I'm talking, by the way, to Roberto Trotta, whose fascinating book called The Edge of the Sky is essentially explaining the universe, the all there is, in the most common used English language words, the 1,000 most common used English language words. You were talking about a poetic straitjacket earlier, which I think is a fantastic way of describing what you're doing. In poetry, we often use the term restraint. And what happens when we use restraint, like let's say we're trying to do a sonnet or a haiku, which you kind of play with in the introduction to your chapters, and we'll get to that in a second. But, you know, what happens is when you restrain yourself to 10 syllables, 14 lines, or whatever restraint you're trying to use, couplets, perhaps you want the lines to be short or you want the lines to be of a certain amount. What happens is that the words become so impacted with energy that it's almost as if every line there's energy pushing on it, and it allows for more of a metaphorical possibility than if you were able to use, you know, as many words as you wanted. And I'm thinking of the student people and the big seer that you just brought up. The big seer, of course, is a telescope because telescope isn't on that list. Yet at the same time, it takes on this metaphorical possibility. It even takes on a character. And so that big seer, it just pushes on so much energy and makes the narrative a lot more complex than the language would betray.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way, Daniel. Because certainly that was the effect that it had on me, the fact of, as you say, being forced to use this very Spartan lexicon really made each single word count. And so it really loads up every word with meaning and different layers of meaning. So it is true that every word on the page is simple. Everybody understands 1,000 words, of course. But because of the metaphorical, necessarily metaphorical and somewhat abstract imagery that those words have to conjure up in order to try and explain the order is, then there is a second layer, much more metaphorical and much more higher level that I'm trying to describe using those words. And so every line is simple, but the images that emerge can be at times quite complex, and hopefully everybody who reads those words will come up with their own mental pictures of what they mean, and insofar as the book succeeds in this new stimulating way of looking at the universe, then I'm happy. And of course, the judgment is with my readers whether or not those images that come up in their minds, whether they mean anything more to them than the images that they've encountered before. And I hope that they will be stimulated to thinking about the universe in a new way. Basically, what I'm trying to do with this concise way of explaining the older age is to put back passion into science. In other words, very often when we as scientists talk to the general public about our science, we talk to their brains and to their intellect alone. But there is passion in science, there is creativity in science, and with my book, I try to speak to people's hearts and not just to their minds.
Right, absolutely. And of course, that always evokes one of the most famous quotes of Einstein, that imagination is more important than knowledge.
Absolutely. And there is another great quote by Mark Twain that says that what you see with your eyes doesn't matter if your imagination is out of focus.
Oh, nice. Yeah. That's cool that, you know, I'm a writer and I quote a physicist and you're a physicist and you quote a fiction writer.
Exactly. That's a great role reversal right here. That's, I think, already a measure of success of the fact that when we go out of our narrow defined boundaries of our work, we can create something new and meet new people and look at the world in a more complete way. And that's great.
You know, I kind of dabble in physics as metaphor, because any system that strives to explain the all there is, theory of everything, toe or whatever, you know, any system that attempts to explain is going to have metaphorical value when it comes to the way we understand reality. And that's why there's a lot of lay physics now that are written for people who are actually turning it into, quite bogusly, a spiritual system. One of the amazing things about physics for me is the language, which is math, the least complicated equation in physics, the more elegant the equation, the more meaning it contains. And I'm thinking specifically of Maxwell's four equations, and I'm thinking of Einstein's famous E equals MC squared. And so in a sense, you're doing linguistically what physicists try to do mathematically.
Yes, that's right. I'm very much trying to find inspiration in the way physics looks at reality, trying to condense in very short, very elegant, very beautiful equations an entire world of phenomena that can be really written down using one single line. The problem with physics, of course, is that the single lines are very highly sophisticated mathematical objects written in a language that only few of us understand. And so how can we try and communicate the beauty and the depth of meaning of those equations to people who have not studied physics, who are not physicists for a living, who don't have a PhD in theoretical physics, and yet who are interested in the object of our research and want to learn more about it? And so I'm very much trying to use this very reduced lexicon to the same effect, to try to condense in a simple, hopefully elegant and hopefully accessible language that everybody can understand the multiple layers of meaning about what we've learned about the old theories and reality all around us. And, of course, I'm very keen to hear from my readers whether or not I've succeeded in that experiment.
Well, the book seems to be doing pretty well, so I would say yeah. You know, even though scientists do get lost in their jargon and they leave us out of it, if I were to go to a lecture with a bunch of physicists, I wouldn't understand anything. But there are a lot of physicists today who are writing books specifically for the layperson, where they convert pretty much everything into metaphor. People like Brian Greene and Michio Kaku, you know, they try to make it easy to understand. They try to make it readable, and they're often bestsellers. What do you think about those endeavors vis-a-vis what you're working on?
I think those are great endeavors. Those are great books and great colleagues who do a fantastic work at making all of this complex notions accessible to the public. The key difference, I think, with respect to what I'm trying to do with The Edge of the Sky, is that when I started doing this experiment, my aim was not just or not necessarily to inform, was more to make people curious about the science behind my book. So I'm aware that there are plenty of great books, some of them by the authors that you mentioned and many others, that are reaching out in a fantastic way and explain in a wonderful way those concepts, but this is not necessarily my aim. My aim is, at the beginning, to try and make people go out of their way and look up for this information elsewhere, if only I can catch their fantasy, their imagination, if I can sparkle in them this interest for this, frankly, exoteric science, and whether they've encountered it before or not, my aim is to really sparkle something inside people's hearts. And if I succeed only at that, I would be already very, very happy.
I really like what you're doing. And the interesting thing is the narrative follows a woman, a student person. She is essentially the main character in this story, because it really is a story, and it's full of images, just like literature, just like poetry, and full of not forced metaphors. Because, you know, let's face it, Brian Greene is a wonderful, wonderful writer, but he really does have fixed metaphors, whereas this has metaphorical possibility. You can take an image here and you can just kind of read a lot into it. But how did she become the center of this narrative?
It was very natural for me, first of all, to introduce this fictional character in order to have a storyline that I could follow and I could use is a way of introducing the various ideas and concepts about the universe that I wanted to talk about. It was very natural to have a character, and it was never a question for me that it was going to be a woman, a female character, even though I'm a male scientist, obviously, but as a communicator of science and somebody who is very keen to enthuse young people for science, I'm very aware of the gender imbalance in our field, where especially at more senior level, the male-to-female ratio can be as skewed as 10-1 in favor of male scientists. And so I think it's very important to try and break this stereotype that science is only for men and it's only for middle-aged and older men with a beard and a white coat, which is not true, but no. Still we need to enthuse more young people, young women for science, and make it clear that it's a great endeavor and a great challenge, but it's a great challenge for everybody. And so to have a female character, as many of my colleagues are women and they do great science, I think it's very important to put this out as a role model of sorts. And make it absolutely clear that science is for everybody, and women can make right. great contributions to science, and they're underrepresented, and we need more of them in our discipline.
Roberto Trotta's new book, The Edge of the Sky, explains the universe, the all there is, in the 1,000 most used words in the English language. And each chapter, and I really admire this, Roberto, each chapter begins with a haiku of sorts, a three-line poem, if you will, that pretty much contains the entire chapter in it. So the chapter about the crazy stars, which as we know now are planets, begins with this: blue worlds going around points of light.
Well, with the haikus, what I tried to do was to achieve a sort of doubly condensed version of the book. So not only condensed in 1,000 words, but condensed in 3 lines in this imagery-loaded kind of way that's inspired by the poetry form of haikus. And so if you put all the 10 haikus, there's 10 chapters in the book, so it's 10 times 3 lines, it's 30 lines altogether, 63 different words. If you put them all together, you get a 63 words description of the all there is, which is slightly too condensed, perhaps. But it's
fantastic, though. That's poetry, man.
Well, I'm trying.
Thank you, Roberto Trotta, for joining us on Words on a Wire, and we wish you the best of luck with this fantastic book.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
A one, a two. A 1, 2, 3, 4. Before he discovered gravity, Newton was hanging round by a tree. Did a little dance in the dark, tripped and fell into that bar. Did the boogie, funky gravity. Did the boogie, funky gravity. Newton did the boogie down by the physics tree.
I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank my guest, Roberto Trotta, the first physicist we've ever had on the show, and now I think you understand why this book is so much like poetry. It's that restraint, describing the all there is in the 1,000 most used words in the English language. It's a brilliant idea, and it's a fun book. I just can't get over the fact that Roberto Trotta is in the same class as Niels Bohr, writing on the chalkboard. One of the sounds I love best is the sound of chalk hitting the chalkboard. When, like Richard Feynman, for example, in his lectures, he's always writing on the chalkboard, writing these equations. And I love the sound of that chalk going tick, 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 tick. And I imagine when Roberto Trotta writes on the chalkboard and clicks the chalk against the blackboard, that the sound might very well contain particles of energy left over by Niels Bohr, or if you want to put it in spiritual terms, his ghost, his spirit, the dead. So we'd like to thank him for joining us on the show, not Niels Bohr, but Roberto Trotta. And remember, the next book you read might connect you with the all there is.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.